always a privilege to be introduced by Dr. G. I never quite know what he's going to say, and he never disappoints me. And I really wanted him to attempt to pronounce those two words, and he can pronounce them. Don't let him kid you. But it was interesting that he sort of slid right by that and let it go. Before I get into what I want to say, I want to make a delivery, and if the person isn't here, he's not going to get what I have. And this is, you know, being offered to this individual who called my office and said he needed a couple of books which are not presently in either the bookstore or apparently in the library, which I don't understand, of the seminary. Nathan Bowman, or Bauman, are you here? Okay. You're quite welcome, sir. Make good use of them. I expect to hear what you did with them. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I know that probably everyone who stands in front of you at a convocation starts out that way. I'm not so sure everybody means it. I do. It's a pleasure because I regard this as a very special kind of opportunity to talk directly to those who are intimately and will be intimately involved in their lives in the most important desire in the heart of God, and to help you to understand that you are specially privileged to be entering into the full-time ministry of Christ at this time in the history of the world, which I maintain is the most exciting and the most challenging time in the entire history of the world and of His church. Now, that's a very broad statement. Part of my problem as I stand in front of audiences like this one is what to share with you. I have so much that I feel is terribly important that you ought to have up here. So much that, you know, you need to be aware of so that you can sensitize the people whom you will lead and be shepherds of. So much that is going on that, you know, the excitement and the enthusiasm that gets God's people in motion and in mission, it's got to come from you. You're going to stand in front of them, and you're going to communicate to them. And what they see and what they hear will determine how they understand their role in God's plan for mission. So how do I share all of this? I always make a resolve that I'm going to give you at least 15 to 20 minutes of questions. Usually I end up with less than that. And then I always walk away from these meetings disappointed that I didn't tell you something else that was in my head. So, we'll just go at it. And I'll see whether or not I can cover once again everything that I'd like to tell you, and I know I won't. But I want to begin with the Word of God. This is not a sermon, obviously. This is an address. And I really don't know what that means either. But at any rate, what I understand it to mean is I'm not supposed to have a text. Well, I am going to have a text, because if one talks about or attempts to talk about that which is closest to the heart of God, and that is His intense desire that all men come to know His Son, and that every knee bows and acknowledges that Jesus Christ is Lord. If one's going to attempt to talk about that, if one is going to attempt to talk about the only reason why there is a church on this earth, and the only reason why you and I are alive, one cannot do that without listening to Him who gave us that mission, and the one who directs that mission, which is the Lord. I have chosen a word. There are two that I could have chosen. One I have used before, so I won't use that one. But a word which will give me the springboard for taking off in some reasonable direction, I hope. It's from Colossians chapter 4, beginning with the second verse. Listen to it very carefully. I'm using the NIV. I don't know whether that's approved at this sem yet or not, but that's what I'm using. That's all right. Paul is speaking. And he says, devote yourselves to prayer, being watchful and thankful. And pray for us, too, that God may open a door for our message, so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ, for which I am in chains. Which sets the scene. You now know where he is, and under what circumstances he is speaking these words. Pray that I may proclaim it, that is, the mystery of Christ, clearly as I should. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation be always full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. If you wanted a passage or a group of words from the Lord, and obviously these are from the Lord, even though Paul spoke them, that you ought to have printed in nice big letters and framed and be on the wall that you look at the most, whether that's your bathroom or whether that's your study, these words would do it. Because there is certainly no misunderstanding of the sense and the direction that comes through these words. There is no misunderstanding at all of the purpose for which you and I are in ministry. Paul speaks it extremely clear. And it is that purpose that you and I have to understand and become excited about. It is understanding a basic principle that underlies what Paul said. Paul was in prison. Paul didn't sit there and moan and complain about where he was. Paul recognized this as a part of God's plan and strategy for him, so that he might, in that place, proclaim the gospel, the mystery of Christ, to people that he would not otherwise come into contact with. Paul proclaims throughout all of his letters, but especially here, he gives clear witness to the fact that he is an instrument of the Lord, and acknowledges that in whatever the circumstance may be, wherever he is, the Lord has put him there that he might do one thing. He might talk about, he might speak clearly about the love of God in Christ to those around him. That is the sole purpose of his ministry. And he recognizes that God has put him in all sorts of circumstances and conditions so that this might happen. Now, I maintain that's where it all starts. And it's something that we've forgotten. We talk about it, but we don't live it. We don't even recognize it as being a reality. That is, that God is in control of this world, that history is made by God, and therefore God is also in control of my life, especially in the lives of those who are his, and especially in the lives of those whom he has called to be his full-time ministers or ambassadors. It is a recognition that there is only one reason why this world still stands. And that is that in some way, somehow, the gospel of Jesus Christ, God's love for man in Christ, may continue to move, to be brought to people who haven't heard it. That's the only reason it stands. And that is the only reason the church is here, and that is the only reason you and I are alive. And when one buys into that concept, one buys into a life of excitement, a life in which one spends all of his time constantly looking for opportunities and sees whatever happens in his life as opportunity to do what the Lord needs him to do. To talk about his love to someone else. Now let me try to make this very clear and understandable. I am so caught up in what I am telling you, and I am so impatient at the lack of understanding in our church and its leadership about what I'm talking about, that there are times when I really don't think I communicate clearly. I mustn't. But there is no other reason for the church to be. There is no other purpose or reason for you to be, or for me to be, except that, to be instruments of God in proclaiming his message. And to be the kind of people who make the most of every opportunity. That's really what I want to zero in on. Who make the most of every opportunity. In order for that to happen, some scales got to fall off your eyes. And one of your prayers must always be, Lord, open my eyes. Help me to open the eyes of the people you have placed in my care, that they may see and I may see the opportunity. It is God who creates the opportunity. Paul says that. God, you know, put him in prison. That was the opportunity, and Paul saw that as an opportunity. It is God who creates the opportunity. That's another way of saying it is God who creates the strategy for mission and asks that you and I recognize that and seize that opportunity. That's our role. Our role is not to create the opportunity for talking to others about his word. Our role is to see it and to use it and to recognize that wherever we are, at whatever circumstances we may be, that is the opportunity. Now, to see that takes some retraining of our minds. I'm going to use some broad illustrations at this point, but they're factual and they've happened. As we live in this world, we are very much programmed by what we hear on television and see, what we listen to. We rely upon the experts, the interpreters of the news, to tell us what's going on. About 3 years ago, 100,000 or better people came to Florida in little boats. They inundated the peninsula of Florida, and they came from Cuba. Dan Rather got on television and his related, anchormen, and told us that what was happening was that Castro was emptying his prisons and emptying his hospitals of terminally ill people and shipping them to us. And we believed him. And we cursed Castro in many ways, if not deliberately, by just simply talking about what a terrible man he was and what he was doing to our country. And then we moved on from there because we were programmed to talk that way, and our conversations began to revolve around the fact that these people are a threat both to our personal security, to our economy, to our welfare system, you name it, because that's what we were told. Now, I can understand that kind of conversation going on among people who still live in darkness. I have a problem with that going on with people who live in light, who recognize and believe and accept the fact that the Lord is in control, not Castro, not Reagan, not Dan Rathers, or anybody else. But it is the Lord who is in control. And to see with the kind of eyes that recognize the opportunity that has happened. And that is, Cuba is one of the 37 closed countries in the world. It is a country to which and into which we can't send missionaries. Not at this point. And there are 37 such countries in the world. Now, does that stop God? It stops us, obviously. No, we can't go in, so we write the 37 countries off. It doesn't stop God at all. For the door swings both ways. And it is the Lord who opens the door and brings people to the Word. That's called centripetal. That's the correct pronunciation. Centripetal. That is the bringing of the unbeliever, bringing of the outside to the center. And it is the Lord now who moves and causes this to happen. Maybe they were criminals. Maybe they were terminally ill, but they are people for whom Christ died. And how dare we make a differentiation? As though they were worse in their deadness and in their blindness than we, before God brought us to faith. How dare we? They are still people for whom the Lord died, and they were brought to this country. In the number one strategy of the Lord that runs throughout the entire Old Testament, let me just share that with you. I wasn't going to, but since we got the words centripetal and centrifugal. About 3 years ago, when all this started to happen, I got very curious about what God was doing in this world and why these things were happening. And so my wife and I sat down to, in our devotions, to do one thing. We decided to read the entire Bible looking for mission strategy. We started in the most unlikely place. We started in the Old Testament. And it wasn't long before we got excited. And as we finished it all, we discovered that there are two strategies. The two opportunities, and there are only two. The first one, you run into right early in the Old Testament with Noah. Once you grab a hold of what really was happening with Noah, a whole Old Testament changes. You'll read everything with an excitement and an interest that you didn't have before, even all those dumb laws in Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, which were not just laws, you know, that God was putting upon a bunch of people because he wanted to make their life miserable, but ended up being a part of his mission strategy. Let me just share with you the kind of conversation that took place between my wife and I as we read about Noah. Here's the world. Have no idea what the population was. Who knows at that point? We can make some guesses, but it doesn't make any difference. It was absolutely corrupt. So bad that God was, you know, sorry, if God can be sorry, that he had even made the whole thing. And he's going to wipe out everybody. But as he looks over the human race, we are told he finds Noah and his three sons. And they're believers. They're loyal. They haven't bowed their knees to anything. And because God is always patient, and by the way, we never thank him for that, I've never yet heard a prayer publicly in which the Lord is thanked for being patient, first of all, with us, and then patient with the whole world. Because it is his patience that enables the Word to continue to move. It is his patience with us that enables us to continue in the high positions to which he's called us. Or he'd wipe us out. But anyway, so the Lord is patient. He says, I want to give all these people another chance. So what does he do? He goes to Noah and his three sons, and what does he say? He says, Noah and his three sons, pack your bags, kiss your wives goodbye and your families, and I want you now to go for 2 years on trips in four separate directions and tell everybody what's going to happen. Is that what he did? Of course he didn't. But that's exactly what we would expect him to do, because the only thing we know is that he said, go into the world. That's the only mission strategy we're aware of. He didn't do that at all. He said to Noah and his three sons, get up on the top of that mountain, take your saws and your axes with you and your hammers, and chop down a bunch of trees and start to build a boat. A huge, ugly boat on the top of a mountain where there isn't any water for 10,000 miles. Go on up there and do it. Now, who would have said that's mission? Only God. Only God. Because as Noah and his three sons go up there to do that, and they begin to build this boat, and it begins to take shape, what happens? The word spreads, right? Curious people. We're all curious. And the curious came. And I would venture to say, that there probably were very few, if any, people who did not hear the message. For 120 years, Noah preached. With a hammer in his hand, he preached. The Lord is going to destroy this world with water. Repent. The boat is evidence. What happened here was then the strategy of the Lord bringing the unbeliever to the Word. That's centripetal. Now you go through the rest of the Old Testament, and it becomes apparent that that was the strategy of the old. God, you know, interrupted it once, as near as I can tell, for dear Jonah and for the sake of Nineveh. And Nineveh was saved, but not because of Jonah. No, Jonah wasn't about to go anywhere. But the main strategy, and that runs right on through, and it helps you to understand what happened in the beginning of the New Testament. After Christ said to the disciples, go into the world, and they sat there and said, oh my, that's marvelous. And the only world they knew was Judea, Galilee, and maybe Samaria. But that's it. But they were locked into the fact. See, God chose Jerusalem. Jerusalem became the crossroads of the world. Millions of people, read Josephus. Millions of people came through Jerusalem. Not like they passed through St. Louis. Oh, no. They could never get through Jerusalem without stopping and saying to somebody, why do you nuts do what you do? See, he created now all the laws, all the special things, all the way in which he set up the whole worship structure. All were done so that people who saw would ask questions. Would literally be forced to ask questions. Why do you do what you do? Why do you run around and offer and kill all these lambs and all this sheep? And where's the God to whom you're offering these things to? Where's the idol? And so you can just go right down the list. And how many people came to faith in the one true God because of this? Nobody knows. Well, we do know that there were many. Because there are many references to it in the Old Testament. But it was bringing, not sending, the Word. It was bringing people, unbelievers, to the Word. God does that today. Both mission strategies, the strategy of going with the Word to the unbeliever and bringing the unbeliever to the Word, are at work today as never before. You don't have to go out into the world to understand what it means to be a missionary. Because that's all you are. Whether you're in North Dakota or whether you're out in India, you are a missionary in the sense that the Lord has called you to proclaim His Word. He brings people from all over the world. I just came out of a conference yesterday afternoon, and I'm supposed to be there this morning. I forgot I was to be here. Of campus pastors who are wrestling with how do we seize the opportunity that God has placed our doorstep? There are 306,000 students from overseas attending our universities. 94% are from closed countries. Countries into which we cannot send a missionary. These are not just ordinary people. None of these students will return to their countries to disappear in the crowd. They've been sent here by their governments. Many of them will be important figures in business, and many of them will be important figures in government. How do we seize the opportunity? They will return to their countries. How will they return? What message will they carry back? how? How do we help those students of ours who are attending universities to be Christ's ambassadors to these people? Terribly important. It is a mission strategy that God is causing to happen and asking us to understand and see it and to seize the opportunity. Let me use an illustration. What's happening today happened back in Acts chapter 8. It's exactly the same thing, but we don't see it. In Acts chapter 8, it begins with the first persecution. Okay? The congregation in Jerusalem had grown. 30,000 on Pentecost, and it, just kept on multiplying. Probably around some 25,000 people are now gathered together. And they had completely forgotten that Christ said, go into the world. It was really a strange concept. They were used to everybody coming to them. Very used to that, and very comfortable with it. And so as this congregation grew, people came to them. They didn't have to go anywhere. So they got very comfortable. Congregation was totally organized, had 12 clergymen, had 8 elders, had a ladies' aid, Lutheran Layman's League, Lutheran Women's Missionary League, board of deacons, whole ball game, altar guild, everything was organized. And they were organized to stay, not to move. What happened? The Lord lifted his foot and kicked them hard. That's persecution. Hey, that's not a curse, that was a blessing. And the Lord moved them out from there, deliberately, forcefully, scattering them. And what are we told? And I love it. Just love it. Because it cuts you and me out of the picture completely. And I think maybe sometimes we ought to be cut out. Because I believe we are more roadblocks and more hindrances than we're good. The apostles, the preachers, stayed in Jerusalem. I don't know where they went. But it was the congregation. And wherever the lay people went, what did they do? It's clear, isn't it? It wasn't the apostles, it was the lay people that went and they spoke about Jesus Christ. And as a result, congregations sprang up and we're not even told where, but they did. It was the lay people. In love with Christ, understanding what was happening through the persecution. You know, they didn't go out and say, hey, you better not join this organization. Because all these nice, marvelous blessings have turned into curses. They saw the opportunity that God had created through their own stubbornness. And they seized it. And there was one guy named Philip who went to Samaria. He's the first Billy Graham of the New Testament. He had revival after revival. Read it! It's one sentence, but it tells you a whole story. Philip was having a ball. And people were being converted, people being healed, and he's doing this. And it's just rolling. God comes to Philip one night and says, leave it all. Can you imagine Philip's argument? He really stood up to the Lord, I'm sure, and said, wait a minute, Lord, you don't know your... Why should I leave all this? Look what's happening for you. It was happening for Philip. Keep that in your head also. Many times it's happening for you and not to the glory of God. The Lord said, Philip, go. Now, why did he want Philip to go? Okay? Unbeknownst to Philip, there's a man who's just not any man. He is the treasurer of Ethiopia, who's been traveling back and forth from Ethiopia on business for his queen to Jerusalem. In the process of those travels, his curiosity has been piqued. He's asked questions, and he hasn't gotten answers. So finally on this trip, he lays out a great deal of personal money to buy a scroll. And believe me, it cost him a packet. Now he's in his chariot going back, and he's reading the scroll. God sends Philip to one man. See, we don't understand the mind of God at all. See, that makes no sense to us. One versus hundreds. Don't ever question the strategy of God. He knows exactly what he's doing. How is he going to get Christianity to Africa? He wasn't going to send the apostles. He didn't have enough. So he didn't pick a businessman who would have had no influence or importance. He picked an important person in the government. The man came to faith. Obviously, by the blessing of the Holy Spirit, was baptized. Now, what did he say after he came to faith? That blew my mind. What would he normally have been expected to say? Let me go back with you, Philip. Let me join that group of believers that you have established in Samaria, right? That would have been normal. He didn't say that at all. He went right on to Ethiopia. And the result is that Ethiopia is the oldest Christian country in Africa. The oldest. For many years, no missionaries ever were sent to Ethiopia. The strategy. In this man, both happened. Both the centripetal, he was brought from the outside to the word, and he brought the word to the unbelievers. Now, there's a sad part to the end of that story which really wraps it up and shows how very little we understand of what's going on in God's working in this world. In 1977, after being in this country for 10 years, Mengistu, who now is the head of Ethiopia, returned to his country. He'd been here for 10 years, training and preparing to take over Ethiopia. The day he returned, he expelled all Americans, and he began an intensive persecution of the church. There are presently 303 Lutheran bishops in prison. That represents a small portion of the eastern part of Ethiopia under this man's leadership. The question that has to be asked, in the 10 years he was here, what happened? What happened to turn him against Christianity and America? That's the question. And that's going to continue to happen unless all of us, and I'm not just talking about you in this room. I'm talking about every Christian. I'm not just talking about Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. I'm talking about every Christian in this country understands what's happening and understands his purpose for being. You've got to communicate that to your people. They have no other reason for being alive. Whatever they're doing, whatever their talents and abilities are, God has placed them there. In that place to communicate to those around them his word. The saddest counseling case I have ever had in my pastoral ministry was a man who came into my office. I was pastor in Detroit, Redford Lutheran Church, for 13 years. Most of the members of my congregation were men who worked on the line for Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors. One of those men came into my office one day. I can't describe the condition he was in, except to say that he was uncontrollably sobbing. When I finally got him quiet enough to ask him what had torn him up this way, this is the story he told me, and there was no answer. There was no way I could help him. He said, "Joe and I work side by side at the Dearborn plant in Ford, the assembly line, doing the same thing for 30 years. We were close. I knew everything about Joe, and he knew everything about me. We knew what we liked, what we didn't like. We knew about our sex lives. We knew everything about each other. And one day, with Joe standing next to me, he fell over and died. He was dead. I couldn't talk to him. I went to the funeral home, assuming that Joe was Christian. To my utter astonishment, and he couldn't finish the sentence. He He broke out into uncontrollable sobbing again, and I knew what the rest of the sentence was. He knew everything about Joe except the most important thing in Joe's life. And how many times doesn't that happen? He knew nothing about Joe's relationship with Jesus Christ. Nothing. He found it out after Joe was dead and discovered that Joe had no relationship with Jesus Christ and had to live with the fact that he would never see Joe again, either in this life or in eternity. There are 1 million people like that, like Joe, in this world. There are 1 million people who are outside the Christian church, 1 billion, I'm sorry, 1 billion people who are outside the Christian church, but among these people live Christians. Let me just bore you with some facts, statistics, and they're boring, but I don't know any way to do it. Because if you don't know this, you know, you might even wonder what in the world you're doing here or why we have a mission program. There are 4,689,000,000 people living in this world. Let's just say 4.6 billion. The population of the world is growing. How many of you heard me say this? How many know what the answer to that is? What's the rate of growth? 1 million every 5 days. 1 million people every 5 days. Net growth, take up residence on the face of the earth. Okay? By the year 2200, if the growth continues and there are no disasters or whatever acts of God that check this and slow it down, the population of the world will have doubled to 8 billion people. By the year 2020, many of you may be alive. I sure won't. But you'll be dealing with an 8 billion or better population of this world, if the world stands that long. I don't believe it's going to. That's another reason why there's an urgency about everything I'm saying to you. I believe that we are closer than ever before. And that's, of course, an obvious statement. We're closer than when St. Paul said it. I believe that the signs today indicate that the Lord is moving. Let me say it this way. The Lord is moving with an intensity that you can't find in history just behind us. I do not believe that the intensity of the Lord's will, his movement in people and nations, was anything like it is today, yesterday. There seems to be an urgency about what's happening. Doors are opening. Things are happening so that people can hear his word. We are having unbelievable technology dropped in our lap in order that his word may get out more efficiently, more effectively, and more economically. But we're so dumb. Gee, are we dumb as church people? No. Especially Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. We are completely backward when it comes to saying that all of this is from God. We don't believe computers are from God. We don't believe satellites are from God. But the Baptists do. And the Baptists have bought a satellite, and so did the Mormons, and they were the first ones to do it. And that really got me angry, because they don't know anything about Jesus Christ. But we're not making use of this. We do not see this as the opportunity that God is providing. All of that technology that increases is not only for our amusement and for us to do a better job as business people, but for the church. It took me 4 years to get a telex machine, and we have a communication with 33 countries in the world. And I had to do it via telephone, via cable, via letter. In a day and age where you can instantly communicate, I finally got one, believe it or not. But somehow I guess in the minds of some people, you know, whatever, that are a part of the church, those machines have little devils running around inside of them. And therefore you don't buy them because they're bad. Blows me away. Part of our being able to move that word is the tools that God is providing for us to do it. Because of computers, I can give you the facts that I started out to give you. How did I get sidetracked? I did. Okay. I can give you those facts. The 4 billion, the doubling of the world's population, the rate of growth. Where does 1/4 of the world's population live? China. 1 billion, 33 million people, by the recent census, live in mainland China. 1/4 of the world's population, of which less than 2%, about 1 point maybe something, maybe, we're guessing, are Christian. Because of computers, I can give you all kinds of facts. I can tell you everything you really literally want to know about those 4.6 billion people. And I kid you not. You ask me a question, if I can't answer, I can find it. Because it's there. Of those 4.6 billion people, we come very close to knowing that there are 1.4 billion who claim to be Christian. 1.4 who claim. And the word claim is terribly important. Because really, 1 billion of those 1.4 are as heathen as those who do not claim anything about the church. Because when we say 1.4 billion, we're talking about everybody who belongs to the state church, Roman Catholic and Lutheran. There are 70 million Lutherans in the world, most of whom reside in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Finland, and a few other related places. Let me give you an illustration of the Christianity of Denmark. There are 5.1 million people in Denmark. There are 4.9985 million Lutherans. There's very few in Denmark then that do not claim to be Christian. Okay, 4.9 million Lutherans out of 5.1 population. In a recent survey, 6 months old, in which a number of questions were asked of Scandinavian Lutherans, of the Scandinavian countries, one of the questions was, how important is God in your life? 94.6% of the Danes said, he ain't important at all. We don't need him. Yet they're in that 1.4 billion who claim to be Christian. You talk about a mission field. You talk about a mission field, and it's the toughest mission field in the world are the European countries, where 96% of the people of France, Roman Catholic, have no use for God. Rarely, if ever, enter a church, yet are Roman Catholic. Mostly atheistic and agnostic. Christianity in England has been declining. Well, when you were over there, Professor Nagel, it wasn't doing anything but doing this. And now it's even worse, going down. You've got some real tough fields. We've got a little church in Denmark, little church in England that are struggling. I spent 5 days with three young pastors. I would say that those three young pastors were, their average age was like maybe 28, 29. One of them is the president of a little church. We have had a free Lutheran Danish church in Denmark for 147 years, as long as this church body, almost as long as we've been a synod. They have a total of 110 communicant members after 147 years. I attended their convention. All 110 were there. But I wish you could have all been there. I really do. It would have changed you. You wouldn't walk away from there the same. Here are Paul's statement when he says in Romans, if it were possible for me, you know, if my going to hell would save my people, I'd gladly go to hell. I saw that at that convention. How do you do evangelism? All you smart people who have all the answers from Kennedy on down, how do you do evangelism? in a country where everybody claims they're Christian. Belong to a church. I sat for 3 days with these three pastors trying to devise a strategy and ended up right where I am in this text, saying to them, "Now you can't devise a strategy. The Lord provides that. Just pray that you will see the opportunity because it's there. And that the Lord will give you the wisdom and the words." Look how Paul said it. "That we may proclaim it as clearly as we should." But he also said something terribly important. And those three young pastors and I worked a whole day on this sentence. "Let your conversation always be seasoned with salt, full of grace. And to that we added, be wise in the way you act toward outsiders." The key to any successful reaching out with the gospel is people seeing Christ in you first before they hear about him. That's what Paul's saying, isn't it? That people see Christ in you who claim to be his disciple. Then you can talk about him. That's what we talked about yesterday with those campus pastors. How do we reach international students? How do we reach Iranians and people from Iraqi? How? Well, you don't reach them by walking up to their dormitory room door and knocking on it and saying, "You know, I want to sit down and talk to you about Jesus Christ." No way. They got to see. They got to see Christ in you. You see, we are as uniquely different as the Jews. Unfortunately, it's very hard to find that unique difference. We are told to be what? In the world, yet not of the world. But do people see that in us? Is there a difference between my lifestyle? And I'm talking about me, not you. You've got to answer that question. Enough of a difference that people can see that there is something different about me. And want to ask me why. Ultimately and finally, that is the evangelism strategy of the Lord. When Jesus was talking about we are the salt of the world and the light of the world, what do you think he was saying? He wasn't saying go to Kennedy School in Florida and learn evangelism techniques. He was saying start living your life as my ambassador. Start living that faith that has made you different from the others. Start letting that light that I have put in you become visible. That's what he was saying. Okay. Really got 400 million Christians in the world. Active, living, believing. How do we get that figure? Totaling up everybody who comes to church on Sunday around the world. There's about 400 million people on the average who attend church on any given Sunday. So we say, and that doesn't mean everybody goes to churches and is, you know, an active Christian. But what else? No, we can't read their heart. So we go by at least where they give evidence of it. So there's 400 million out of 4.6 billion people. That's all. But that ain't all bad. There were 250 million people when Christ said to the disciples on the mountain, you know, go into the world, and there were only 11 of them. And that meant that each disciple was made responsible for 22.5 million people. With 400,000 of us, that means each one of us is made responsible for 10. Now, I know you can make figures say anything you want them to say, but it's an interesting concept, isn't it? And the dear disciples didn't sit down on that little mountain and say, "Well, we've been told to go out in the world. We've got to sit down now and get organized. We've got to have, you know, a board of directors and a budget and a mission board and an evangelism committee." You know, they went out and they did it. We love committees. They keep us from doing what we should be doing. We talk about how we should do it, but we never do it. All right, I'm not going to get done if I don't shut up. All right, the 400 million people who are Christian. All right, take the 1 billion, leave them alone, that claim to be Christian. That leaves 1 billion people Well, really, there's 3 billion people who are outside the Christian church. 3 out of every 4 people on the face of this earth, alive at this moment, are not going to heaven, they're going to hell. By the way, I'm rather astonished as I go around to Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, and I usually make this statement in a Bible class. I'm astonished at the people who challenge that statement. It must be, you know, I guess it's a sign of the times or something, but we just don't put people in hell today anymore, apparently. And I guess maybe that might explain, in fact, it will explain, if that's where we're coming from, why we're not really on fire for Jesus Christ. Why should you be? If there is another way in which people can make it. If because men have not been told about the gospel, God has some other way to get them there, he surely won't put them in hell. I don't know how many times I hear that statement. Then why are we involved at all? They are going to hell without Jesus Christ. There's no question about it. And God has done everything, my friends, except one thing. Tell them. He's left that up to you and me. He's prepared the mission, the gift of his son. He moves out with the strategy and says to you and me, sees it. He isn't going to let angels do it, because only those who have experienced what it means to be forgiven can talk about it. Only those who know what it means to be free from the fear of death can talk about it. So there are 1 million people, 1 billion people, who live where other Christians live. They're the Joes I talked to you about before. No special training is needed. No languages are needed. No cultural learning is needed. They're your neighbors. They're the people you carpool with, walk with, talk with, play with, whatever. But there are 2 billion people in this world that we call the hidden peoples of the world. It's a technical term. Doesn't mean we don't know who they are. They're made up of 17,500 groupings of people. Identifiable groupings. These are people among whom there live no or extremely few Christians. 17,500 groupings of people. Those are the people that I believe the church must marshal its resources to reach. Those are the ones to whom we send specialists we call missionaries. Who are willing to go into another culture, to learn another language. And that sometimes takes 5 years, as it does in Korea. To learn it well enough to be able to communicate it and to think in it. So that the people to whom you are communicating understand you. That's the specialist. The people to whom we send this kind of person. These 2 billion people are the burden of all evangelical churches, all churches who understand why they're here on earth, to plant a church, to bring Christ at least to one, to each one of these groups by the year 2000, is a goal that a number of us have adopted personally. A number of mission execs in evangelical churches and I had a meeting. We have pledged ourselves to marshal our church body, both its financial and its manpower resources, in the hopes that God will bless our efforts so that we plant at least one Christian church in each one of the 17,550 groupings by the year 2000. This gets complicated by the fact that there are 7,010 languages spoken in this world. 1,811 have writing. The difference, 5,000, whatever it is, their languages have not been reduced to writing. But again, God is moving here. I believe that today the Tower of Babel is reversed. We have linguistic skills we never had before. We have computers that enable us to take a language that normally took 20 years to break down and do it in 7. And I maintain that in another 2 years we'll have computers that will help us do it in 5. So the Lord has moved so that once again we can do it more efficiently, more effectively, and faster. These 2 billion people are the ones that we want to concentrate on. Our church has not done that. We have rather concentrated on the churches we have already established. And it's time to reach out and to reach into those areas of the world where the gospel has not been brought. And by the way, you need to know what that means. That means that when we say we're sending a missionary to Sierra Leone, which we are doing, and we're not sending that missionary to the country. There are only 223 countries in the world. And all of those countries, in some way or other, have Christianity, except those 37 that are closed. We're talking about within a country like Nigeria, for example, where I was a missionary, there are 396 separate nations. Because there are 396 separate languages spoken. So when we say we're sending a missionary to Nigeria, we're not really. We're sending a missionary to the Ezi tribe, which we did 2 years ago, among whom there has, as far as we can determine, never been a Christian effort. There's no evidence of missionaries ever going to the Ezi people. We're sending a veteran missionary from the Philippines to two tribes in North Sierra Leone. As near as we can tell, in one of them there's never been a missionary effort. In one there was years ago by the Anglicans, and the evidence is some churches that are in disrepair. There are no believers left. There apparently is no result of that work. We're going in there. But you also need to know that today it's not easy to do it. And I'm not talking about the cost. The cost continues to escalate. And that's one of the reasons why we have the personalized missionary support. Not only to help with the cost, but to help our people feel involved in reaching these people. But it is difficult because governments today, all of these countries, when I went out in 1948, a lot of these countries were colonies. We had no problems going in. I don't even remember. I remember getting off the ship in Nigeria and going right back into the jungle with no problems of any kind. Today, you don't do that. You don't establish a mission unless you work through the channels that have been established. And many times those channels are not channels we like. We've got to go through councils of churches in countries in order to get a visa for a missionary to take up residence. It's becoming increasingly difficult. But the Lord still is in control. Let me just share an illustration with you. We sent Walter Moss up to North Togo to a tribe that was a spillover from Ghana, where he had been working in Bungpurugu for like 16 years, to begin work now on the other side in Togo in French, our first entrance into French-speaking country in West Africa. To get in, we were told, we had to have the approval of the Council of Churches. We were assured that if we were patient, we'd get it. Now, we had the approval of the Council of Churches. That meant that we would be limited by them as to where we could go. We didn't want that. But there was no other way to get in. And nobody was working up north, and our hope was that we would be assigned by them to work up north. So we sent Walter Moss and his wife to Lomé, the capital, to live. 6 months went by. No word. 8 months went by. No word. This meant sort of constant visits by Walter Moss, you know, gentle visits to the embassy, to the state, you know, to the religious organization, all of that. No word. One day, without any kind of warning, I received a very official-looking letter in French, came to my desk, and no idea what it said. Opened it up. It was very short. It was about 8 sentences, all in French. Well, didn't no. Got out. Found somebody, translate it. What did it say? It was the Togolese government giving us permission, independent of the Council of Churches, to take a permanent residence in the north part of Togo, where we wanted to be. Now, don't tell me that wasn't the Lord. It was a fluke. Can't believe it. No, it was the Lord. As a result, we're going to be sending 3 more missionaries up there without asking anybody. Because the government has granted us sole right and privilege. to do mission work among those people. Now, we've got to stay on good relationship with the government, and we're doing that. You see how the Lord works. It is the Lord who opens the door, and that's the other thing Paul said. Remember that little thing I said? Pray that the Lord will open the door. That's part of what we've got to always pray about, that the Lord will open the door. Then we have to have the kind of eyesight that sees that door open either in or out and seizes the opportunity. Let's stop. You can ask questions. If I get going on another subject, you won't get out of here, and I see some of you are already falling asleep, so let's just back it off. Some of you have to leave. Are they supposed to get up and get coffee and donuts as a part of this 11:30 business? Okay. Anyway, I'm open to questions or whatever you may have. I have not covered the scope of the work that we do as a board for missions or my staff or any of that other stuff, but that's it. Okay. May I just field them? A lot more, okay? We had a meeting about 2 weeks ago of selected pastors who are deeply involved in ministry to the Hmong, the Vietnamese, the Cambodians, the Thai, and one other one, the five East Asian groups. We were astonished at the kind of ministry that is going on. We had an idea. Our people are involved in sponsoring, these refugees for homes. But we didn't know whether there was any ministry going on. I had authorized the translation of and had paid for the translation of three books in those five languages as kind of instructional books. To our astonishment, we discovered these are being used, and it's just simply going to have to receive a lot more publicity. That's part of the centripetal thing I was talking about. Now, in the last 15 or 20 years, the amount of immigrants or refugees that have come into this country alone is astonishing. You can't really get a figure. I've heard 80 million. I've heard, all kinds of figures. But here is the ministry, and many of these come from countries in which it's very difficult, to do mission work. Thailand, for example, is a closed country. Yeah, it's open a tiny bit, but for all intents and purposes, it's closed. We're trying to get into Thailand. But while we're trying to get in, we've got all of those who have come here from Thailand, so that there needs to be an awareness, and I don't really know how that happens. Your question is an excellent one. We're aware of it at the level, at my level, how we communicate. So what we tried to do then was to pull these pastors together, help them, let them express what they're doing and what needs they have. We receive requests for vicars. We receive requests for evangelists. We are intensely and deeply involved in trying to study what may be interpreted as levels of ministry. We believe most firmly that if we are going to, work among the Hispanics and all the other ethnic groups that are coming into this country, we cannot, we can't rely upon the fact that we're going to get among and bring them through the system. But we have to train them where they are. All of these things are being worked with. Okay, I'm familiar with the Baltimore, but it's far broader than that. Our biggest challenge at this point is not only the Southeast Asians, but is also the Hispanics, and we're trying to sensitize the church to these challenges. And it's not easy. Okay. There's a history to the problem, and I'm speaking as I have tried to assess that question, because I was disturbed when I came on board 5 years ago at the number of missionaries. Part of it is completely understandable. In countries like Nigeria, in Korea, in Hong Kong, in the Philippines, we have seminaries. Out of the work now has come a national church, and there are seminaries, and these seminaries are training evangelists and national workers. After all, the missionary ought to be, by my definition, the specialist who goes in and breaks ground, in the process of breaking ground, trains nationals to be functional leaders, to take over as he continues to move. Well, the result of all of this work that we have done, Nigeria since 1936, Korea since 1958, etc., has been that there are church bodies, and these church bodies are responsible for the area in which they now live, for the ministry, for the evangelists, for whatever. We should not be sending missionaries to partner churches except for specialized needs. That would be like, in the seminary, or for the training of, theological education by extension, business manager. We use laymen for business managers where the church requests that because they are not reached that point. But Our need now for missionaries to open up new areas is where it is. So part of what happened to the number of missionaries is understandable. It went down because nationals were being trained. What's not understandable is that from 1958 to 1978, we didn't open a new mission in the world. That's what's not understandable. And if you're not opening new missions, you don't need missionaries. Obviously. Okay? And if the missionaries are not, being used to break ground where they are. There was also a part of this was that the understanding that was a part of Protestantism, and I'm sure Roman Catholicism was involved in it also, in the 60s and early 70s, and it goes back into the 50s, that the job was done. Christianity, we've been doing this since, Christ said to the disciples. And after all, the Christianity is everywhere. And then came in syncretism and universalism during those years, beginning really back in 1948 at a couple of major conferences. These two philosophies began to permeate the churches, and we didn't escape it. And so if you then believe, number one, that the job is done because, the time has been so long, and number two, you believe that you don't really have to do it because somehow God will fix it up so they all get there anyway, which is a simplistic way of talking about universalism and syncretism, then what do you need missionaries for? The commitment to missionaries, to send missionaries into the world, that we asked the Synod to make in 1979, shortly after I came on board, of 600 missionaries by the year 1990, was my response to what I saw and to my understanding of the challenge that's still out there. No, little bitty organizations, associations have 1,000, 2,000 missionaries out in the world. Well, I can't get up over 150 at this point. I don't think I'm even that high yet. But it's going to be a matter of, I'm bucking sending missionaries to established partner churches. I'm saying, that's not what we're supposed to be doing. I'm asking my area men, when they go out on these trips, to identify places like Sierra Leone, those two tribes up north, where we can send missionaries. So I anticipate that number of 600 may not be attained, but we will be close. Two things are happening. Number one is the Lord is opening doors. Since I took office, we've begun work in five new countries, five new areas of the world, five new tribes that were not worked in before. Okay? Number two, the manpower resources are here. Our seminaries have more enrollment than ever before. And number three, don't tell me the money's not there. It's there. We just know how to get it. Period. So that all that is there, all that is needed is in place. It's now moving it. And that's part of my responsibility, to see to it that it happens. And to help our church understand why it's there. Why we are a church, and to get excited about being a part of God's plan and being involved in mission. You know, we have got to change the concept. Everybody is a mission. Everybody is in mission. We don't say that. No. What, two-thirds of you will end up, maybe more than that, being pastors of congregations. That's wrong. You are a missionary wherever you go. And I think when that begins to happen, something's going to change. Change for the better. Yeah, okay. You respond to it by having the scales off your eyes and seeing what I said. It is God who's in control. Okay, if a country closes its doors against Christianity, that's not by accident. All right? That's a part of the overall plan. God then moves into that and opens the door the other way. I believe most firmly that we have no business getting involved in what's called underground movements, subversive movements, smuggling movements. Because to me, that's trying to play God. And we create more antagonism to Christianity when we use these kinds of methods. Now, I stood in front of a large rally in Dallas, Texas, and I never said it before, but it somehow fit in what I was saying. I condemned Brother Andrew. Well, I didn't almost get out of Dallas. I almost got lynched because half of the audience supported Brother Andrew and thought it was a good thing that he was smuggling Bibles into communist countries. Because of Brother Andrew, the door to China almost slammed shut. Today, if you want to go into mainland China and you have a Bible, it's going to be stamped in your visa, and you'd better have that Bible when you come back out. And that wasn't the case until Brother Andrew tried his massive Bible smuggling operation and got caught. We don't, aren't we told to obey the governments? As far as I am concerned, it's the Lord is in control. He'll figure out a way to get the gospel either into or bring that country out to the gospel. We got to be ready to do it. Not to divert our energies and our time to breaking the law, to smuggling things into closed countries. Now that's personal, okay? There are probably many who disagree with me, but that's where I stand. No question about it. Okay. When you're in a structure, you're in a structure. You got red tape and all that sort of stuff. I conceived this, what you're talking about, shortly after I came on board because I was aware of what you're talking about. I had a large congregation in Detroit that wanted to be involved. We couldn't get involved, so we supported an LBT. You know, over and above everything we did, we supported an LBT for $500 a month for 10 years. Never quit. Never missed. In the meantime, our budget went all the, went up. We had a big day school, a whole ball game. So when I came on board, I was determined that we would, as a church body, offer our people the opportunity to become personally involved in mission, in a missionary. Because you can multiply those churches. There's a little church in Atlanta, Georgia, that's Episcopalian, that's got 328 members that personally supports 84 missionaries in full. So, it can be done. We just haven't given them the opportunity to do it, okay? So, in devising the program, my goal in devising the program was that people in our church body would become personally involved in the mission. So that on their stationery would be Walt DeMoss, and therefore their mission is not only in their community, but also in Togo. The money was incidental, completely incidental to the whole program. Because the money will follow when people are involved and excited. And I discovered that people are simply sick and tired of buying canoes, jeeps, and paddles and mimeograph machines. They want to become involved in people. So that's how the program was devised. Well, it was perceived as money raising. by the stewardship department of the church and a few other departments. It ran into violent opposition in districts as a threat to the district income. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, that's the Missouri Synod. You have to learn to roll with it, live with it, and finally it all begins to happen and it turns around. So now it's beginning to turn around. It's slow, but it's picking up momentum. Give it a chance. Right now, because I couldn't get this in any other way, I have the authority to purchase services without asking anybody's permission. One of the few things I can do without asking permission. I got a former missionary on my staff who's gonna ride herd on PMS. He's going to start visiting circuits where congregations request and explain it and get the circuits involved so that we don't have a missionary supported by a congregation in New York and one in San Francisco. Because that's self-defeating for the poor missionary.
We have three more questions.
Three more questions.
Grace and then two, three.
No question about it. Oh, no question about that, and it will happen. Yeah, you know, that's part of what I can't, you know, how much am I supposed to tell you, okay? Through Brazil, we have work in Portugal. Through Brazil and Argentina, we have work in Paraguay and Uruguay and Chile. Okay, we are not as such involved, but through our support of those, you know, two major church bodies, you know, the work has gone into other countries. Brazil is getting ready to call a Japanese pastor. There are close to 10 million Japanese living outside of Sao Paulo, somewhere in that whole area in Brazil. Okay, so it's a whole community. I believe, you know, with the Korea is thinking of sending missionaries into, of all places, mainland China. Did you read that the other day? You know, so this is going on. You know, and thank God for it. Because we certainly, if it was up to Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, it wouldn't happen. Yeah. But we are a part of the whole Christian church. And we, you know, if we're going to claim we are, then we should be actively involved in the business of the church. Now, obviously, I can't speak for the Presbyterians and everybody else. And I don't want to sound as though we're the only ones doing it. Thank God we aren't the only ones doing it. So there, you know. I'm not really familiar with that one. That's gone by me. Which denomination has that? Oh, okay. Yeah. That's really not a denomination. No. Right. And they have probably more missionaries out than any other individual or association or organization in Christendom. And that's why they have these kind of conferences. They don't know what to do with, by the way. It's very interesting. Their whole thrust is into the world. They don't know what to do with the Vietnamese and the Cambodians and Thai who come to this country. They really don't. Yeah, but they really don't know what to do with them. It's a whole new ball game for them.
Yeah, I think that was because of your time and also.
Yeah. Well, there's one more question.
Two more.
Okay. Okay, I'll try to answer very quickly. All you do is write to my office and I'll give you all the information you need on the missionary support program. Okay, Dr. Herbolth is in charge. Number two, the business of support personnel, builders, etc., is what you're talking about overseas. There are very few countries that will today grant a visa to a volunteer builder. Countries maintain that if we do that, we're taking away employment from their own. So it isn't like it used to be, where, you know, you could send a volunteer into any place, literally, and they build the mission houses or the churches or whatever. There, at this point, we can send a volunteer into Liberia and to Togo, and I don't know whether we can get one into Sierra Leone. It's just gotten that tight. We need volunteer builders, for example, in Nigeria, where our church is really exploding and expanding. We can't get them in. All right, but don't go in under the guise of being that and do something else. That's dishonest. You're going to send a builder in. They are a lay missionary, but they're a builder. Yeah, we can do that. The other side of the coin is that the partner church, if we're going to do it in a partner church, must request it. We can't just do it, okay? There isn't that much in the way in which we're structured that we can do with lay volunteers. I get these requests all the time. There isn't that much that we can do with them. I don't know what we're going to do. We may have to do something because I get so many requests. But I'm not aware that an awful lot is being done with other denominations. I lost you. I don't get the logic. I don't get the bridge between not having money and first now working with the back. I don't get it to me.
Well, it seems to me our church people say we don't have money to do this. Well, if that's the reason, do we do anything like a combined with other denominations, such as Baptist countries or something, to help go into a mission field? That'd be a feasible thing to do if we're not doing or what?
No. Number one, I don't complain that we don't have the money or the manpower. I don't know who does it, and I know there probably are. But as far as I am concerned, that's a useless complaint because we have both. You'll never hear me say we don't have the money or the manpower.
Okay, would it be feasible
though
to combine our efforts
with other denominations? No. No. Simply because. How much time have I got to answer that question? Let me try to back into it, okay? Do I use other denominations? No question about it. Before we went into the two tribes in Sierra Leone, I called my counterparts in the other two Lutheran churches and the Baptists to find out whether or not they're going in. Because if they are, we're not. We can't afford to waste the resources and the manpower to go into an area and be in competition. I recognize the Baptists as being valid Christian preachers. I mean, I don't agree with everything they do or say, but they are people who bring Christ to people. We will not go into competition. That's why I thought I said very clearly, we will not go into an area where the Christian church already is established or another Christian denomination is already working. All right. Now, yeah, there is a working relationship. I'm also very impatient with the situation like we have in Taiwan, where we have 15,000 Lutherans who belong to seven different Lutheran synods. That borders on stupidity in my book. And I'm trying to get them to merge and become one Lutheran church. I didn't say that. Nobody heard me say it. But those kinds of things we're dealing with. All right? But what you need to know is that we are not going to go into competition. Not anymore. We did it in the past. That's done. Okay?
Well, thank you, Dr. Westcott.
My
thank
pleasure.
You for your... We thank you for what have been said so far. I know there are many things not said. You know, for that reason, you have to come back sometime, soon, I hope. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.